This is Jeff Spittler, May 21st, 2000, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 25. James and the Church, 1606 to, we hope, 1621. Okay, so last time, just to give a quick summary, James acceded to the English throne, and within a year of his arrival, he held this Hampton Court Conference, which gives a pretty good indication of how he plans to treat the English Puritans. And even though he's now about 400 miles from Edinburgh, his plans for putting the Scottish Church under his thumb do not diminish. Okay, so he continues his policy of dividing and conquering. He intimidates and or persecutes the militant part of the church, or the conservative part of the church, the non-conforming part of the church. And he flatters, bribes, cajoles, etc., the remaining ministers and elders to do his will. He appoints bishops, so they're not called bishops at first, but it only takes a little bit of time. We also initially have some constraints, which they're soon constraints are soon ignored. And as we, one of the struggles that goes on is these will be appointed to be constant moderators. Okay, so James, still having problems with the Scottish Church, he. And still knows that he can run the church better if he gets rid of some of the more troublesome ministers. He's already gotten rid of 14 plus or something like that. So, but apparently these other ones hadn't been at the right meeting at the right time to get into trouble. So,
were they in jail?
Well, 14 of them were, they were, I think, in prison at this time. Eight of them, the outcome was, I think, eight were... Or maybe it was six. There's six in one group and eight in another group. One group was basically banished to like the Highlands and the Western Isles and so on, which pretty much the ends of the earth at this time. And the other, the remaining six or remaining eight were actually exiled to France. Although they were probably still in prison at this time.
Fate worse than death.
Fate worse than death, being sent to France. Well, at least they could eat well, so. And no, actually, a number of them serve Protestant churches in the France and in the below country. So, in a sense, it's a bad fate, but it's probably, of course, not. It's a lot better than being executed. So, one of the ministers that was exiled to France was James. I think it's James Welsh. I wasn't going to bring him up, but he was. Actually, Knox's son-in-law, and so years and years later, Knox's daughter comes and asks James if he could be allowed to return to his native soil, and he says that he could, but he gives him this long list of constraints. In other words, if he'd agree not to preach and you know, and so on and so forth, then he would say okay. But she held up her apron and said she'd rather keep his head in this than. Follow those constraints. So he died overseas. So okay, so James he ordered eight more ministers, including Andrew and James Melville, to come to London for a quote conference. They were commanded in May of 1606, but they were supposed to arrive in London no later than the 15th of September. And within a week of arriving, he called them in for a meeting. Or I should say within a week of when they were scheduled to arrive. They actually arrived earlier than the 15th of September. But he and the Scottish Privy Council met with eight ministers, and the king put two questions to the ministers. These were, did they approve of the General Assembly meeting in Aberdeen, the one where the delegates had come, but there had been no commission from the king to hold a meeting? And all they did was try to schedule a real meeting of the General Assembly. And also, the other question was, what was the best way to establish a peaceful meeting of the General Assembly? So the ministers requested they might consult with each other and return an answer next day, and that was granted. But when they came back the next day, they found not just the King and the Scottish Privy Council, but also a number of the English and Scottish nobility, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, and it also turned out that there were a number of English bishops and deans hiding behind the curtains, as it were. I guess they said hiding behind the tapestries that led to the next room or something. But in other words, sort of where they could hear the conversation, then they came out when it got heated. Okay, so the king was basically looking for something to hang the ministers on. He asked them each to answer the question. When he got to Andrew Melville, he said, What say you, Mr. Andrew? Think that a small number of 8 or 9 met without any warrant, wanting the chief members, the moderator, and scribe, convening unmannerly without a sermon, being also discharged by open proclamation, can these make an assembly or not? And he, Melville responded at length for an hour, but just to give you a little flavor of it, this is from McCree's summary. Let's see. As for himself, he said, he had for a number of years been debarred from attending on general assemblies and all public meetings. But as it was his Majesty's will, he would endeavor to give him satisfaction on the different objections which he had stated. With respect to the paucity of members, there was no rule fixing the precise number. 2 or 3 met in the name of Christ had the promise of his presence. An ordinary meeting of a court established by law could not be declared unlawful on account of its thinness. And those who met at Aberdeen were sufficiently numerous for proroguing the assembly to a future day, which was all that they did and all that they had proposed to do. As to their warrant, it was founded on Scripture, His Majesty's laws, and the commissions which they received from their presbyteries. The presence of the former moderator and clerk was not essential to the validity of the assembly, which in case these office bearers were either necessarily or willfully absent, might, according to reason and the practice of the church, choose others in their room. His Majesty must have been misinformed when he said there was no sermon, for one of the ministers of Aberdeen preached at the opening of the meeting. As to the alleged discharge of the assembly on the day before it met, turning to Lauriston, and this was the king's commissioner in Scotland, the one who came and ordered the meeting disbanded, he later claimed that he had posted this proclamation at the, at the Market Cross before that. Melville said to him, I charge you in the name of the Church of Scotland, as you will answer before the great God at the appearance of Jesus Christ to judge the quick and the dead, to testify the truth and tell whether or not, whether there was any such discharge given or not. In other words, had he really posted a ban on the meeting the day before? He paused for a reply, but Lauriston remained mute. And the king, fain to break the painful silence, requested Melville to go on to state what reasons he had for not condemning the conduct of the ministers. Keep in mind, this business with the meeting being banned ahead of time was not just related to Melville's discussions here. It was also related to the case of these other guys who were sitting in prison. So if the meeting hadn't been banned, then the case against them isn't near as black as it would be. So he goes on to give his reasons for not condemning the ministers. If it please your majesty to hear me, I have these reasons. First, I am but a private man, come here upon your majesty's letter without any commission from the Church of Scotland, and as no body has made me a judge, I cannot take upon me to condemn them. Secondly, your majesty hath, by your proclamation at Hampton Court, here he produced the proclamation, remitted their trial to a general assembly, expecting there reparation of wrongs if any have been done. Okay, so he basically goes on to say that he's not, it's not his position to judge them, and that how can he judge them if he doesn't hear their accusers objecting against them and them answering, without a regular sort of trial to judge against. So, okay, so the king got somewhat irritated, and he terminated the conference. The ministers left, but they were quickly tracked down, and they were charged not to return to Scotland, nor to come near the king, queen, or prince. So they were basically had to remain in London. And they were ordered sort of a week later to come before the Scottish Privy Council again. And when they arrived, they got there. They got started asking them more questions about their opinions and beliefs. I don't quite understand the Scottish sort of civil rights at the time, but apparently the accused had the right not to accuse themselves, as it were, if that makes sense. In other words, they didn't. If it was against the law to hold an opinion, they didn't have to state what their opinion was. So, in fact, James Melville said, I am a free subject of the kingdom of Scotland, which hath laws and privileges of its own, as free as any kingdom in the world. To them I will stand. There hath been no summons executed against me. The noblemen here sitting and I are not in our own country. The charge super inquirendus, was abolished and declared long since to be iniquitous and unjust. I am bound by no law or reason to accuse myself. So they were asked to give an answer to three questions, and that was what these were slightly different, but again, he's mainly just fishing for something to hang them on. So whether or not they had been wrong to pray for their condemned brethren, the 14 ministers who sat in prison at the moment, and if they would beg the king's pardon for this, okay, whether they admitted that the king was within his royal prerogatives to schedule or not schedule meetings of the General Assembly, synods and presbyteries, and whether or not the king was within his royal prerogative to call any of his subjects before him and his council and judge them on either ecclesiastical or civil grounds, and also whether or not the subjects were bound to appear and obey. So hopefully what the king is hoping for is that they would refuse him in strong language. So they returned a written answer in a joint paper, and McCree characterized it as guarded but uncompromising. Okay, so still they weren't free to return home, and in fact the archbishops tried to persuade some of them to change their views. They were spied upon. They were provoked. They're living in London. They were ordered to attend a series of sermons given by the English bishops and academics. They took notes and suggested that those sermons be published so that they could issue a formal reply. The sermons were published, but then the ministers were sort of split up and they were made to lodge with different bishops. They were forced to attend a feast for St. Michael, and the king and queen came and, I don't know, did some kind of offering or something. I don't know exactly what, but there were two clasped books, two empty glasses, and two unlit candles on the altar. And Melville, not having anything else to do, when he was back in his lodging, wrote a little poem in Latin, a rough translation of which is, and if it were me giving it, it would be very rough, but it's printed here, so. Why stand there on the royal altar high, two closed books, blind lights, two basins dry? Doth England hold God's mind and worship close, blind of her sight and buried in her dross? Does she, with chapel put in Romish dress, the purple whore religiously express? So, but anyways, he didn't give this out to anybody, but a spy found a copy in his room. And so later, the 30th of November, he was called before the English Privy Council, and they produced this copy, and it wasn't even a good copy. But the Archbishop of Canterbury accused him of a terrible libel on the worship of the Church of England, a high misdemeanor, maybe even treason. So, let's see. Melville's response. I'll read this more for your enjoyment here. My lords, exclaimed he, Andrew Melville was never a traitor. But, my lords, there was one Richard Bancroft, this is the Archbishop of Canterbury. Let him be sought for, who during the life of the late Queen wrote a treatise against His Majesty's title to the crown of England. And here, pulling the Corpus Delicti from his pocket, is the book which was answered by my brother John Davidson. Bancroft was thrown into the utmost confusion by this bold and unexpected attack. In the meantime, Melville went on to charge the archbishop with his delinquencies. He accused him of profaning the Sabbath, maintaining an anti-Christian hierarchy, and vain, foppish, superstitious ceremonies, and silencing and imprisoning the true preachers of the gospel for scrupling to conform to these. Advancing gradually, as he spoke to the head of the table where Bancroft sat, he took hold of the lawn sleeves of the primate, shaking them and calling them Romish rags. He said, if you are the author of the book called English Scotizing for Geneva Discipline, then I regard you as the capital enemy of the Reformed churches in Europe, and as such I will profess myself an enemy to you and to your proceedings, to the fusion of the last drop of my blood. And it grieves me that such a man should have His Majesty's ear and sit so high in this honorable council. So, anyways. But for that thing, he was found guilty of the crime of Scandalum Magnatum, which a rough Latin translation by myself is big scandal.
Yeah, starting one?
I don't know. So he was first confined in the custody of the dean of St. Paul's Church, and then he was tossed into the Tower of London from May of 1607 through April 1611. So he spent nearly 4 years in the Tower. Tower today, of course, is a tourist site, but it was the prison for sort of state prisoners then, ones who might be treasonous or had displeased the king. And I think the sort of the quality of accommodation there varied, but he was kept in an unheated cell. He endured, James King Hewison said, even yet it pains one to think that while the heartless, unscrupulous, semi-popish sovereign was amusing himself by cockfighting, hunting dotterels, whatever those are, writing inept pamphlets, and doing worse, the most finished scholar and brightest intellect of Scotland was caged in a damp, cold, fireless cell during the bitterest of winters, 1607 and 1608, with not even a pen to chase out the weary hours, Melville being forced to engrave his ideas upon the prison walls with the tongue of his shoe buckle. Okay, and this was fairly common in the Tower for people to write on the walls, only they didn't have anything to write with, so they had to scrape, you know, nothing else to do. They sort of engraved it with whatever piece of metal came at hand. If you go to the Tower today, you can see all kinds of little bits of writing that they have preserved. Yeah, I don't. If you go like to one of the rooms where they have this, you know, they'll have like little pieces of plexiglass with a little notice to what, you know, whose writing it was. I don't remember seeing Melville's when I was there last, but even then, you probably wouldn't be able to see very much of it because I think, on the nature of the case, you know, you had to eventually, when it all got covered over, you had to maybe scrape out what somebody else wrote and write your own stuff. So, okay, finally in 1611, he was allowed to leave the country and teach theology in Sedan, France. Actually, a French nobleman wanted Melville to come over and teach, and so he kept requesting of the king that he be allowed to do that, and finally the king assented and sent him off there. He taught there until 1622, and he died at age 77. He was in fairly good health and good spirits until the end. Okay, his nephew James Melville was ordered to live in Newcastle. Okay, so he wasn't allowed to return to Scotland. He died before his uncle, and the other ministers were allowed to return to Scotland, but they were confined within certain parishes, you know, and sort of under something like house arrest, but maybe not quite as bad. Okay, so James now again following this familiar pattern of persecution and intimidation and then trying to push something through with the rest of the ministers. The Scottish bishops rushed home, right? They'd been there the 30th of November, and on the 10th of December in Linlithgow, they held a, quote, general assembly. And this time, the presbyteries were informed by the king of who they should send, or who they were to send, as their representatives. And with a lot of pressure from the king, they allowed the bishops to be the constant moderators of the presbyteries. Okay, so, and then when the king ratified the measure, he added that they were also moderators of the provincial synods, which became something like a diocese, so they had bishops over each of these provincial synods. Now, did the church resist? Yes, all but one of the synods refused to allow the bishops to moderate their meetings, but nevertheless he had it on the rule books there. And for the next several years, the bishops worked at forcing the presbyteries to accept the situation. In a 1609 parliament, the bishops were given the power to fix the salaries of the ministers. And, according to Hetherington, this was a power which they did not scruple to employ for the purpose of bribing adherents and of starving antagonists. So if you weren't favorable, you'd get, you know, a very low salary pittance. If you were favorable or could be bought, you could get a higher salary. Let's see, on the 16th of February, 1610, the archbishops of St. Andrew in Glasgow, they were given commissions to hold what were known as courts of high commission. Court of High Commission was a tyrannical court. It was like a star chamber, one that didn't have any fixed laws or rules about how it operated. It could take kinds of evidence that no civil court could take. And they could investigate both civil and ecclesiastical issues. So this is sort of the Scottish Inquisition, if you will, or at least they had the power to do so. I'm not going to spend much time today on the courts of high commission, but I think next time we'll see how they used the power. Another so-called General Assembly, and again I say so-called because at this point it's basically hand-picked representatives, was held in Glasgow on the 8th of June, 1610. They passed a number of acts which confirmed the king's prerogative over the church in scheduling assemblies, confirmed the bishops as constant moderators, gave them powers of excommunication and absolution, or you could say a restoration from excommunication. And actually, specifically, that's all excommunications and all restorations from excommunication had to be approved by the bishop. So it'd be possible this way for some noble who was a friend of the king's to get by with adultery or whatever and sort of escape by means of the bishop saying, no, we won't excommunicate this guy. They were given the responsibilities of approving, appointing, and as necessary, deposing ministers. And this assembly was later called the Angelical Assembly, because the gold coins used for bribing the representatives were called angels. So that's why it was called the Angelical Assembly. Okay, the acts of the assembly were ratified and slightly extended by Parliament in October 1612. And at this point, James's overthrow of Presbyterian church government was essentially complete. Now, been working through this and try to interpolate from different sources, you know, what's happening at various times. And this isn't mentioned in any of the Scottish church histories, but I found this interesting. This was October 1612. In God's providence, James's eldest son, Henry, Prince of Wales, the one who was sort of good-looking, athletic, apparently a Protestant of some, thought to be the hope of Protestants, refused at one time. There was some possibility of negotiating to marry the Infanta of Spain, the princess. And he said as long as, you know, he was prince, the two religions wouldn't lie together in the same bed. Don't know much more about him. He died in November the next month, November of 1612. So whether or not James sort of built his city at the cost of his firstborn son is an interesting question for discussion. So what did James do next? Well, in the course of things, when he wasn't busy with his favorites or hunting or cockfighting or whatever, he turned his attention to worship. Okay, so up until now, he just worked on church government, and now he's going to get to worship. A general assembly met again in August of 1616. It drew up a new confession. The new confession was somewhat vague on the issues of church government. And then in 1617, James visited Scotland. Okay, he'd been absent for 14 years. Travel being as difficult as it was then, he didn't just like I did in March, you know, sort of buzz up, start out in London and buzz up to Scotland and then come back on a one day all the way from, or nearly all the way from Glasgow to London. So he managed to get things off on the wrong foot. I think in 14 years he'd maybe forgotten how obstinate they were up there. He had an organ delivered to the Holyrood Chapel with gilded statuettes of apostles and patriarchs on it. And while he was there, David Calderwood was a minister. He was also a minister. He was a historian. He wrote this history. A lot of the original source materials for the, say, 19th century histories and even today come from his history of the church. He was called before the High Court of High Commission. He declined its authority, and the king became incensed with him and had him exiled, literally sending him off on a boat in the middle of the night in bad weather, and made some comment to the effect as if it overturned, it would save him from a worse fate. Okay, so the king and the bishops prepared for a while, and then on the 25th of August in 1618, they held a general assembly in Perth. He gave them five articles to consider, all of which you might think of as being moving the worship in the Church of Scotland closer to worship in the Church of England. So he again, you know, commanded who to send, etc., and he submitted five articles for them to ratify, if not to consider. So he didn't care if they considered them as long as they ratified them. The proceedings were highly irregular from a Presbyterian perspective, perhaps very regular from an Erastian perspective. When the ministers had arrived, they found all the seats were taken by nobility, gentry, and bishops. The Archbishop Spotswood sat down as moderator, even though he hadn't been elected. He was challenged. The minister said there should be an election according to their constitution. He declared that since the meeting was taking place in his diocese, it was his prerogative to moderate it. So then they challenged the ability of the all these nobility, gentry, and gentry to vote. They weren't elders, most of them, or you know, to the best of their knowledge, most of them didn't have a commission from the presbytery to vote. Spotswood declared that they were in effect commissioned by the king. So, you know, you can see he's pretty much completely subverted the church government. A letter from the king was read urging the assembly to vote for the proposed measures, and the Dean of Winchester, right, an English bishop or prelate, I guess he wasn't a bishop, urged them to do what the king had asked, and this is Hetherington's word, in a strain of sycophantic adulation. So, it's one that was worshipful to the king. Okay, all debate on the measures was suppressed, and the ministers were threatened with, if they voted against this, that their names would be reported to the king. And the vote for the measures was taken with this question: will you consent to these articles or disobey the king? That was their two choices. And they had 45 ministers, one nobleman, and one doctor voted against the articles, but they still passed. The articles, there were five of them, and I'll summarize them, but I'll read one to just give you an idea of the language they were cloaked in. Okay, so you there should be no doubt about the ultimate aim, but they're still worded in a way that sounds, that will sound maybe perhaps plausible to someone who's weak-minded or wanted a reason to compromise. So let's see. The first one has to do with kneeling. I guess this is the fifth one in my list, but let me just read this one. Seeing we are commanded by God himself that when we come to worship him, we fall down and kneel before the Lord our Maker, and considering withal that there is no part of divine worship more heavenly and spiritual than is the holy receiving of the blessed body and blood of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, like as the most humble and reverent gesture of our body and our meditation and the lifting up of our hearts best become us so divine and sacred in action. Therefore, notwithstanding that our church hath used since the reformation of religion to celebrate the Holy Communion to the people sitting, by reason of the great abuse of kneeling used in idolatrous worship of the sacraments of the papists, yet seeing all memory of bypassed superstitions is past, in reverence of God, and in due regard of so divine a mystery, and in remembrance of so mystical an union as we are made partakers of, the assembly thinketh good that the blessed sacrament be celebrated hereafter meekly and reverently upon their knees. Okay, so they had, you know, partly you could say as a reaction to the Roman practice, they had, you know, but also based on the principle that there was no biblical, direct biblical commandment to take communion on their knees. They took it sitting, and here they were being forced to follow the English practice of taking it on their knees. Let's see, the other ones required a celebration of holy days. Let's see, there were five of them: Christmas, Good Friday. I guess Good Friday, it says celebrating Christ's passion, the original, Easter, and the Ascension, and also the sending down of the Holy Ghost, which I presume is Pentecost celebration. I know when I was in England, the celebration of the Ascension is still, even in otherwise biblical churches, they don't make a big deal about it, but people are still keenly aware of the church calendar. And in the Anglican church, it's definitely celebrated. Let's see. Another article allowed private baptism. And this, you know, probably has more to your view of what baptism is for. You know, is it a covenant, sort of a sign and seal of a covenant, you know, to be made in the presence of witnesses, or is it some kind of regenerational thing where you, you know, quickly get in there and baptize if there's some exceptional circumstances? Let's see. Children were to be catechized, and they were to be presented to the bishop for him to lay hands on them, bless them, and pray for them. It also allowed private communion, which again would go back kind of away from the covenantal viewpoint and towards other viewpoints, I guess. And as I already mentioned, we required that communion be received in a kneeling position. Okay, so the purpose of these articles was to bring the Scottish Church into closer conformity to the Anglican Church. And they were ratified by the Privy Council on the 21st of October, 1618. And they added this feature, or if you will, that those who did not observe the act shall be repute, holden, and esteemed as seditious, factious, and unquiet persons, disturbers of the peace and quiet of the Kirk, contemners of our just and royal commandment, and shall be punished therefore in their person and goods with all rigor and extremity to the terror of others, at the arbitrament of the lords of our Privy Council. Okay, so they added a quite, you know, threatening penalty to this. Okay, they were in turn ratified by the Parliament on the 4th of August, 1621. And still, it was by a small majority, even in, you know, Parliament. So interestingly, at the very moment that they were ratified and the Lord of Session or whatever put his scepter down, a terrific thunderstorm hit. And thunderstorms, at least in my experience, are fairly rare in the United Kingdom. I don't remember seeing any. I don't think I saw any lightning while we were there. Nothing like here. Okay. A terrific thunderstorm struck with lightning. There were sort of three very loud, you know, very close, bright, loud strikes, very loud thunder, large hailstones, and rain coming down so hard that they were, quote, imprisoned in the building for an hour and a half. And so this day was known for some time as Black Saturday, and according to Calderwood, it was black with man's guilt and with the frowns of heaven. Okay. James, he's about dead here. He's got about four more years to live at this point. He is going to continue to persecute people, but this is sort of his last sort of official act in terms of writing stuff. So wait a minute, or... Okay. Just about done here. So, Hetherington makes several points about this, which I kind of followed on, slightly different view, but pretty much this is Hetherington's view. So, about this whole struggle for prerogative and with James being ascendant. Okay, so first, the church that sort of follows Christ truly may be expected to incur the hostility of the world. That's no surprise. Second, I think if you look back to all the things that happened, internal corruption in a church is a great danger. And some of you have read like Gary North's book on the Presbyterian Church in this country in the last century, and you know what happened there. One way of looking at it is to say that ministers were not disciplined when they should have been disciplined, and by the time anyone got around to doing it, it was too late. To some extent, the same thing happened in Scotland. James used a two-pronged approach. He persecuted and he exiled the faithful and effective ministers, you could say the ones who were faithful, but also who could forcefully and eloquently argue the point, the ones who would stand up to the king and argue with him. You know, probably the ones who didn't argue well, he wouldn't consider as much of a threat. So he persecuted, intimidated, got rid of those, and then he attacked from the inside by corrupting the other ministers. And it was done sort of, even that was done in two ways. Obviously, some were corrupted in the most base ways possible, payments of cash and preferment of privileges and so on, like the bishops. And others were sort of subverted, I guess that's the right word, by making them jealous of their colleagues in Edinburgh and so on. And some, of course, you know, if we, like I read that first act, it, you know, on the surface it sounds very sort of plausible. It doesn't sound like, oh, you're just going to follow this practice because that's what the English do and I want it this way. You know, it has kind of a nice sort of lead up to it as to why you do it. So some were maybe subverted by means of being given a path to compromise. But he did clearly use the church to sort of further corrupt itself. It wasn't from without. And in fact, he was in a sense forced to acknowledge the Presbyterian claim. None of the acts that subverted the church were started with Parliament. They were always ratified by Parliament or approved by Parliament. The destructive acts all originated from within the church. Now, okay, you could say, like looking at this last assembly, well, you know, he packed the assembly and so on, and that's true, but he always used the church all along, you know, admittedly, you know, with all that he could do to corrupt it, but he always used it all along to sort of further its corruption, you know, change, mold it to his view of how things should be. I think next week we'll talk, I'll probably try to summarize on James and his views, and I have some, I think maybe some more interesting material just on how he viewed things. But he clearly viewed himself as being smarter than everyone else. He hated Puritans, thought he was an absolute free king and monarch, and these were people standing in his way. He only had to answer to God. Yet the way he lived, one would think that he probably didn't think that he had to answer to God. So, okay, well, I'll stop there. And Vicki.
World Magazine recently had an article by Beach kind of commenting on how we're seeing the results in Europe and in the Scandinavian countries of state-run churches.
Uh-huh. That was a very interesting article.
What was their name?
Well, the lack of influence on society and how especially how it's reflected in families, like black families, black marriage.
Yeah. I think you could say his point relevant to this situation was that the church that's sort of set up by the state and answers to the state becomes subservient to the state, and that's what this church in Scotland is in the process of happening in the church in England and so on. So, I mean, here it's very obvious in some respects, you know, perhaps more subtle in democracies and so on. Mike.
I'm surprised though the preachers, at least in this last conference talk, the courage of those ministers to think about that. All the nobility there, and they were voting against, you know, the ones that did vote against, I mean, and they were handpicked by the king. So he picked the best, the guy who was more lenient towards him to begin with, and yet they still did.
Yeah, well, in some presbyteries he maybe didn't have too much of a choice, but he didn't need to have point, you know, he didn't need to appoint every person. Every person in the assembly didn't have to be his, you know, exactly in line with him. All he needed was a majority. And still, though, like you said, we had 45 ministers, you know, and they were presumably men that he had chosen, you know, that voted against him. Dan.
We didn't talk much about the King James Bible.
Yeah, I completely skipped over it. It was 1611 that it was issued.
What was it? I mean, basically, did he just take the Geneva Bible and remove all the notes, or was it a true translation? Did he go back and, I mean, if you take the Geneva, I haven't looked at the Geneva Bible. If you take the Geneva Bible and the King James Bible, are they, did he monkey with the text or the translation, or is it pretty much exactly the same?
That's sort of beyond the scope of my research. I mean, my understanding is that it was a new translation.
Okay.
You know, it's widely regarded to be a very good translation. And Henry is going to interject on this.
King James Version, you've got a whole lot of experts together, new translation, and King James very close to the death, Steve Burroughs, or whatever they're called.
It was very close to the, I think, the Textus Receptus is, yeah. I think it's, yeah, I mean, to this day, it's widely regarded to be a good translation. He did have sort of, the best experts of it.
His objective was to get the notes out of it, right?
That's what I've read, that his objective was to get rid of the notes that came with the Geneva Study Bible. I don't have any proof. I mean, I certainly don't have a quote from him saying, go to it, boys, we've got to get rid of these notes, you know, but that's...
And is there in the literature, is there any indication that effort bore any significant fruit in the corruption of doctrine in the church, or was it just James the Billy Conn fiddling around with something else?
I have yet to see anything that blames the translation or ascribes the translation some part in the corruption of the church. I mean, they didn't burn their other Bibles or anything, so... my understanding is it's a very good translation, so I don't... that was... what can I say? Rob? Not that I know. I mean, I've never seen anywhere that it was banned or anything like that. Merely that they produced this new Bible. As far as I'm sure, it was used certainly in the English churches and reading the liturgy and so on. But I've never seen anything that it was banned or anything like that. So, he did ban a lot of other things like Buchanan's works and things like that. But not as far as I know that any other version of the Bible. So, okay. Mike, would you close in prayer?